Welcome to today's INFJ School lesson, INFJs and attachment styles. What causes distance and pain in the connections that mean the most to us? Today we're talking about attachment styles in relationships with the unique spin of looking at them from the perspective of being INFJs. Today, I am thrilled to tell you that we have a guest expert with us who I'm going to be having a conversation with today. Through our conversation, we're going to touch on and really expand into what's most relevant for us as INFJs to understand about the way that attachment plays out in our relationship. So allow me to introduce Jen Lum, licensed marriage and family therapist. She has a practice in Pasadena where she specializes in working with all kinds of couples, gay, straight, partners, dating, engaged, married, transitioning out of a relationship together. She does it all. And she also works with individuals who are wanting to work on their relational self. Jen just brings so much expertise to the realm of relationships and connection. I'm thrilled she is here with us today. And best of all, Jen is an INFJ herself. So, yay. So you have the viewing pleasure of watching two INFJs who are both therapists, both approach therapy from an attachment perspective, and who are also INFJs here today. All right. So Jen, let's dive in. The first question I'm going to ask you is pretty basic. For those of our viewers who are not familiar with attachment and what that means, how would you define or describe attachment, just to start us off?
Sure. Well, first of all, thanks for having me. What an honor to be a part of this wonderful community of INFJs. I would define adult attachment as the romantic love as a grown-up version of the emotional bond between your primary caretaker and child, which means even as adults, we have the same need for a safe haven, for secure connection, for the kind of safety in our relationship that lessens fear and stress. It also lessens the same emotional turmoil we feel at the threat of loss of separation. It is the need for connection and secure attachment is literally wired into our brains when we're born and small and helpless. And it's this exact same code that we have now as adults.
Yes, that's beautifully put. Mm-hmm. And attachment really started, for the sake of our viewers and listeners, I'll say, I think attachment theory began with John Bowlby in the 20th century, British psychiatrist. Mm-hmm. And he primarily in his career studied the bond between mothers and infants. Right. And developed our understanding of human attachment from that. And in his career, I think toward the end, he began shifting and talking about the fact that attachment needs don't go away when we become adults, that our, like you said, our attachment needs as adults just typically shift from that cellular level need for a bond with a parent to a cellular level need for a bond with a significant other. And that can be someone who we're involved with romantically, a partner, or that can be a really deep friendship. It can be an attachment that has continued with one of our parents or a family member. I think what I really want our INFJ students to hear is that the same survival level need that infants have for an emotional bond and a sense of closeness with their caregiver continues into adulthood, even though we may not rely on our significant person for our physical well-being the way that infants do.
Right.
I love how you use the word code. It's encoded into us to feel a survival sense of well-being.
Mm-hmm.
We're bonded with someone who's reliable and reliably connected to us. Mm-hmm. And then we feel survival level danger.
That's
when
right.
That important attachment is threatened.
That's right. That's right. I would describe a secure connection that we all need as three different words: accessibility, that we know our significant person is accessible to us. And they're responsive to us, meaning if we call out, we can rely on this significant person to respond to us, to say, I hear you, what do you need? And then lastly, that we can rely on them to be engaged and really engaged with us. And when we can feel accessibility, responsiveness, and engagement from our significant person, that is where the sense of security comes in. And like you said, that starts from the moment we are born into this world to the moment we leave. This is what we need. And perhaps the only major differentiator between adult attachment and attachment as infants is, as an adult, we may not need our significant people physically present at all times. We have the ability to turn to them in our minds if the relationship is strong. So we can separate physically, right, in a way that infants can't. But besides that, you know, the primal need for secure attachment is all the same.
Yes. Oh, that's so beautifully put, that as we become adults, just thinking about our significant right. person can lend itself to a sense of safety and well-being, even if they're not physically present.
Absolutely. And they've done plenty of research now, with brain research, seeing the impact of when loved ones just simply think about their loved ones, the level of stress hormones that go down, the cortisol levels that go down, just knowing that there is a reliable relationship, that you're not alone. Has a significant impact on how your body responds, how your mind responds, how your hormones respond. It's incredible.
Yes.
And on the flip side, if you don't have the secure connection, the impact that it has on your whole well-being, there's plenty of research done on that as well. That is why, corporal punishment includes isolation, because mm-hmm. humans literally are not meant to be alone. To be alone is threatening on a life and death level. We cannot
right.
survive without each other.
Right. And for those INFJs who are listening and thinking, I love being alone, let me say that there's such a huge difference between our personality wired need for solitude.
Right.
Which feels best when we know that we're securely connected to people,
that's
even
right.
though they're not right here with us. When we know
right.
that there are people out there to catch us if we fall or to turn to when we need support.
Right.
But here you're talking about, I hadn't heard that before, so thank you, that isolation is also considered corporal punishment, because when we humans have a felt sense of disconnection from mm-hmm. our primary people,
mm-hmm.
We experience that as a survival level threat.
Yes.
So if a child has, done something wrong and is being disciplined by their parent by being put into isolation, the child is sitting there with the knowledge that, my caregiver or my parent is not pleased with me. I'm feeling a disruption in my sense mm-hmm. of secure attachment to them or connection with them. And
right.
now I'm being exiled, to my
yes.
room or wherever it is. And that's a very different experience, even for us INFJs, than choosing solitude in order to recharge.
Absolutely. Yes. From what I understand too, the recharge in solitude is like an energy recharge.
Yes.
It's like a physical space where a physical space and time where you can recharge. That's very different than saying, I can't draw upon any relationships, even in spirit, in mind, where I feel like I am known. And that's like an existential aloneness that we're talking about. Of course, we physical aloneness sometimes is so enriching, but we're talking about like an existential aloneness where I'm not known anywhere. If I call out in a time of need, no one will even hear me or answer my call.
Right.
That's the deathly kind of aloneness that will send us into a primal panic when we don't feel like we have a secure connection.
Yes. Oh, that's so beautifully, beautifully put. For mm-hmm. those of you listening, if you're sitting there going, wait, I can't think of any relationship I have in which I feel, 100% secure. My closest relationships, whether it's with my parents or my partner or friendships, my closest relationships are fraught with a sense of disconnection and a lack of security. Hang in there, because the good news that we'll be talking about toward the end of our time today is that healing is accessible.
Absolutely.
For the many, many of us who didn't grow up necessarily with a sense of secure connection and attachment.
Absolutely. Yes.
So let's talk about the two categories of attachment. We've got, on one hand, secure, and then insecure. And we're going to be getting more deeply into the attachment styles that that fall under the insecure category. But let's start out just talking about what secure attachment looks like. People who grew up with none of us, because we're all human and our caregivers, we're all human. None of us grow up without emotional bumps and bruises and relational bumps and bruises and moments where we feel like no one is there for us. So Jen, talk to us a little bit about, in that context, what secure attachment looks like.
Absolutely. So secure attachment is when, like we said, there is a felt, almost a wonderful expectation that if I call out, that my significant person, people will be attuned to me and responsive to me. And what is built then is this safe haven and bonding where you can really relax into it. A safety that will eventually lend itself to play. Dr. Sue Johnson has this wonderful metaphor of when couples or just two people are in a safe relationship, safely bonded, safely connected relationship and are safely attached. It is like being securely attached to a zip line where you go on at this amazing adventure and you're free to adventure and play and not need to worry about detaching yourself from the zip line. So on the flip side, if you're worried about detaching, that's where your mind is focused on the whole time, is how am I going to be okay? But when you're safely attached, there is a certain kind of let go freedom that allows you to adventure and be curious and break boundaries and in a wonderful way and see life in more colors and laugh and have fun and experiment and brainstorm, and all those mind expanding things happen when we're feeling safely attached to each other. So I would say feeling emotionally safe lends itself to play. And the same goes with talking about also our sexual connection. There's definite positive correlation between feeling a sense of safe connection, emotional connection with our partner, and our ability to have fun and take pleasure in our sexual connection as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's like things really open up when you have that sense of mutual trust. That's then right. You can take risks, and then you That's can right. play and have fun and adventure. And, right. and that brings so much more ease, right, to a sexual yes. connection.
That's right.
So much more of a sense of possibility.
That's right. Exactly.
You know, listening to you made me think of the studies that were done, I think a few decades ago. Again, this goes back to infants and mothers, but the meaning that, you know, the results apply mm-hmm. very much to adults, where infants and mothers were taken into a room mm-hmm. And then they observed, like, an empty room. The infant had never been there before, and they observed how the infants responded to sitting there with mom and then mom leaving the room. Mm-hmm. So toddler. Mm-hmm. So the toddler was alone and then mom coming back. And what they found was that with toddlers who had insecure attachment, when mom was in the room, they clung to her. Of course, these studies were all done with mothers. It absolutely applies to fathers and any gender of parent.
Right.
But the toddlers clung to their mothers and wouldn't explore the room when mm. their attachment sense was insecure.
Yes.
They felt like, this is a new experience. I'm feeling afraid. I need to make sure mom doesn't go anywhere.
Right.
There wasn't that sense of ease. Like, of course mom's going to be here. Of course she's going to stay. The securely attached toddlers, on the other hand, wandered around the room, picked up things, you know, explored, and they would keep coming back to mom to check in,
mm-hmm.
but then venture back out again. And that's right. such a beautiful illustration of adult secure attachments, is that when we feel that sense of knowing that this person is going to be there for us through yes. thick or thin, we can really rely on a secure emotional attachment with them. We can go out, we can explore, we can adventure and have fun, and That's just keep right. touching base with that person.
Exactly.
And then during the part of the study where mom left the room for a few minutes and came back, the insecure toddlers just fell apart when she left, right?
Right.
And when she came back, they weren't entirely sure she was going to stay. So there's a very That's mixed right. emotional response to mom. Whereas the secure kids may have felt, you know, afraid or mm-hmm. a momentary sense of where did she go. Mm-hmm. When she came back, they really joyfully reconnected with her because there hadn't been a deep down survival level fear that she's just gone away forever.
That's right. That's right. That's right. There's this internalized feeling of safely being tethered to mom, yes. that whether she's inside or outside the room, we're still connected.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. So on an adult level, I think what this looks like is that when we have a secure attachment style, when we're feeling hurt in one of our primary relationships, when there's a miscommunication, you know, when we're feeling disconnected, deep down there's this belief that the other person fundamentally cares about us,
mm-hmm.
and that reconciliation is around the corner.
That's right.
That's an incredible shift, you know, an incredible, incredible shift from insecure attachment, which really questions during moments of connection, during moments of disconnection.
Right.
Insecure attachment really questions, is this the end? Is this it?
Yes, yes, yes. The threat seems so much stronger. There's much more at stake when there is a threat, which I know we'll get into later, really triggers then even stronger levels of coping strategies to either avoid the threat altogether or to recover from the threat, right?
Yes.
Right.
So actually, let's get into that.
Okay, perfect.
There are two, for those of you tuning in, there are two main types of insecure attachment, anxious mm-hmm. and avoidant.
Mm-hmm.
And so let's talk about anxious and avoidant attachment, just sort of in a nutshell, because we're going to talk about deeper examples in a minute when we get to the roles that each insecure attachment style takes on.
Sure.
But in a nutshell, Jen, how would you describe, let's start with anxious attachment.
Sure. Well, I'll say that these strategies come from the basic understanding of fight or flight. Mm-hmm. When we are in primal panic, which right now we're talking about emotional disconnection as being a primal threat, right?
Right.
When we suffer a loss or a threat of loss of connection, the part of our brain that that processes fight or flight gets ignited. And so when we talk about anxiety or anxious, the anxious coping mechanism, that is a little bit more like the fight. Those of us who will fight the bear, fight the shark that's coming after us.
Uh-huh.
And so usually what it looks like when we are anxious is we will try to increase the volume, increase the heat to try to call out, we are in danger, we are in danger, can you hear me? If that makes
right.
sense.
Right, so we increase our intensity mm-hmm. Of trying to reach, emotionally right. reach the other person.
Exactly.
When we have an anxious attachment style.
That's right.
The volume on our emotions, as we, I mean, I'm, mm-hmm. we're not pretending, the mm-hmm. volume on our emotions goes mm-hmm. up.
That's right.
We're feeling our emotions intensely. Mm-hmm. And we are getting intense in our, sometimes we talk about bids, the bids we mm-hmm. make to try to reestablish connection with that person.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So that's, and we can go definitely more into like specific strategies yes. that those make, but that's for in a minute, right?
Exactly.
Okay.
So let's now talk about avoidant attachment.
Sure.
In a nutshell, how would you describe avoidant attachment?
So avoidant attachment then is more like flight in the sight of danger. So avoidant might be shutting down and numbing yourself, getting away from what the threat is. So whereas the anxious strategy might be, increase the volume of our reach.
Mm-hmm.
The avoidant one might say, let me take this need away and go somewhere else with it. Let me go away from the relationship.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. So would it be fair to say that the anxiously attached person doubles down on their attempts to reconnect and to feel reattached, and the avoidantly attached person detaches emotionally?
Yeah, I would say in a nutshell. Though I think that, yes, definitely in a nutshell. Though I would also say that in both strategies, both people employ their strategies as an attempt to try to secure and protect the connection.
Yes.
I will say that for the anxious strategy, it might look a little more obvious as to how they're doing it because they're fighting yes. for it. Whereas the avoidance strategy, their strategy of pulling away is actually in their way trying to protect the relationship.
Yes, thank you so much for saying that. That's absolutely true.
We'll it's harder to see, course. Though. But,
it's harder to see above the surface, right? Through the avoidantly attached person's behavior, mm-hmm. it's harder to see that they are really trying to preserve and protect the connection also.
Right. By okay. taking their needs somewhere else.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. So we've hinted at this, but people mm-hmm. with anxious attachment styles then tend to operate pretty differently in relationships than those with avoidant attachment styles. Jen, you mentioned earlier Sue Johnson, who is the founder of Emotionally Focused Therapy, or EFT, mm-hmm. Which is an attachment-based model for couples therapy and now for family therapy and even individual therapy. And a fun fact is that you and I actually did our training together. We've both completed advanced training in the EFT model. And whereas I use emotionally focused therapy primarily in my work with individual clients, supporting their relationships through one-on-one work, you've really taken your EFT training to the next level by working with, you know, working primarily, I think, with couples, right? And applying yes. that attachment-based knowledge to your work with couples. So Sue Johnson, through her extensive practice as a couples therapist and her extensive research, has identified two roles that we, one of which each of us tends to step into when we are experiencing insecurity in our attachments. And the first role is pursuer. And pursuers are the folks, those among us who are anxiously attached. And then the other is withdrawers. And withdrawers are the folks who are avoidantly attached.
Right.
Let's talk a little bit about the different ways that pursuers and withdrawers show up in relationships and operate in relationships.
Sure, let's do that. So the first one, like you said, would be the pursuers who are anxiously attached. And this means when there is a threat of disconnection or when attempts for reconnection don't pan out, you know, the first few times, and that fear really sets in, like I'm not safely tethered to this person, then the fight response kicks in, which is I am going to kind of emotionally put myself out on the line here to really try to get a response. And sometimes it's, you know, maybe I'm not getting a response because my cries are not loud enough, both figuratively and sometimes literally.
Right.
So typical strategies for a pursuer would be, you know, how can I be heard? Maybe I'm not getting a response right now because I'm not being heard. So this could be either actually getting louder sometimes, or the bids for connection can start to get a little pointier, can get more demanding, can get more critical. Anything to try to say, let me get this through to you because you are probably not hearing me then.
Right.
If that makes sense. So
it does.
Right.
So the pursuer, when the pursuer is feeling either disconnected from their person or like there's a threat of disconnection looming.
Yes.
Maybe the conversation is taking a argumentative turn or, you know, maybe the other person doesn't seem that connected or engaged. A pursuer is going to get louder, like you said, perhaps literally, definitely figuratively, going to try even harder to connect and to be seen and to be heard and to feel not necessarily validated, but acknowledged.
Yes. Yes. That their cries, their genuine cries, their need for connection is finally being received and responded to.
Right.
Like they're finally feeling like their other person is accessible or engaged or attentive.
Right. And they're going to keep calling until that happens.
Yes, they will. Okay. So I also like to say, so while many pursuers may increase, you know, their energy and voice, there's another also type of strategy I see. Sometimes pursuers will take us a different route and be completely silent, but the silence is loud, if that makes sense.
So I'm really glad you're bringing that in.
That makes sense. So maybe regardless, it is very palpable and felt that there is a cry. There is a cry to say, I need you. Though I want to back up and say, part of why Sue Johnson says that couples get stuck in a rut is because what you see on the outside is coping strategies, but what gets buried underneath that is the very primary call for connection.
Yes.
What I mean by that is, as we're going through these different strategies, we're talking about what it looks like as a fly on the wall, or what it might look like through the eyes of your partner or someone else standing at the room, what we see the person do as they cope may not always be very clear that what it is a cry for connection.
Right.
I see couples in my room, and sometimes a pursuer will get angry, a little spicier, maybe in the vocabulary, any way to be heard. And it might come off as, oh, she or he is really angry, or they're very critical, or they don't like me, or they just don't want me. And that can be the flavor or the interpretation of the partner or the other person. Mm-hmm. And what is getting lost in the strategy is actually this really underlying call for connection. This right. fear, the fear is not being translated through the coping strategy.
Right. The pursuer inside is feeling just a dearth of what they need. Like a sense of complete starvation and deprivation for connection how intense it can get. It's not always that
absolutely.
Intense.
Absolutely.
Yep. It can quickly, when we're talking about our primary people, feeling a sense of disconnection for pursuers can feel like an inner death.
Yes.
It can feel like I am starving and my, you know, depending on whether your partner is a pursuer or a withdrawer, it can feel like your partner is just deaf to your cries.
Right.
And so pursuers can get, after a while, pretty angry, pretty critical. And that pursuing behavior starts looking like telling your partner everything that's wrong with them.
That's right.
In terms of everything that they're doing wrong in the relationship that is leaving you feeling so starved.
That's right.
Your partner is not necessarily going to understand, well, 9 times out of 10 does not understand where that the absolute need and drive for connection that behavior is coming from.
That's right.
All they see is that they're being told that they're incompetent and unloving and, that they're just not doing this relationship right.
That's right. That's right. That's the message they get. And oftentimes when I see, when the couples are in my room, when this is being explained to the person who is, the partner of the pursuer, they're usually very surprised to learn that actually this is a bid for connection.
Right.
Because in the moment, in the heat of the moment, like you said, the only message that they're hearing or experiencing that moment is, you're not good enough.
Yes.
You're not getting it.
Right.
I don't like you.
Right.
What they're not hearing is, I'm sad we're not closer. I need you. I want you. And I'm just so starved and hungry and scared I'm not going to get that connection again.
Right. I'm desperate. Yeah. That's so beautifully put. And it's so resonant. Let's talk about the way that the withdrawer operates.
Sure.
In a relationship.
Yeah. So withdrawers will have more of, like I said, a flight response, which is when they see the threat of disconnection, landing in their relationship, they will take their need elsewhere or numb their need. The need never disappears. Like I said, this is hardwired into all of us to need this kind of level of connection.
Right.
But a withdrawer may employ strategies to numb the feeling of it.
Yes.
And commonly, those with an avoidance strategy or a withdrawing strategy, this strategy can come from, chronically not having bid for connection being met. And so this ends up being their adaptation of, if I call out and it's not being met, then I should not call. I should not call to not be disappointed and to not put myself in the situation where I'm chronically disappointed.
Right.
So the solution then is to shut down, to numb the feelings, to go elsewhere with the temporary need. And that can look like, in the moment, everything from being quiet, maybe appearing like you're disappearing from the conversation into a different place in your mind. It could look like literally leaving, physically leaving the conversation, going to the room, leaving the house altogether, driving away. And it could also go as far as to going to other relationships. And this is sometimes where affairs may happen. This can look like addiction, going to other places, substances, you know, places where you can numb the feeling of having such a real need, feel like it won't be met. Also, these folks tend to experience these moments, especially when they feel heightened, if they are in a relationship with a pursuer, they can tend to more easily feel the overwhelm of emotion and energy, and need to feel like they need to take shelter underground. So that is partly why that might be an explanation for why some of these withdrawers seem to suddenly go away, not just verbally, but also non-verbally. You might, a pursuer might feel like they're suddenly talking to a wall, for example, like I'm not getting through. I'm employing all my strategies to be heard, and I'm talking to what feels like a brick wall. What's happening behind that brick wall is a withdrawer running for shelter, waiting for the storm to pass. That storm not being the other person, but that storm being, oh my gosh, our connection is insecure right now. They're not happy with me. This is not good. We're, you know, our relationship is in a dangerous place. I'm going to wait for this moment to pass. And when it feels like we're in a safer place, then I can emerge and maybe we can talk through this, you know, in a way that feels manageable to me.
Right.
And so that's another example where, you know, a pursuer may not understand why this person is going away. It's not that they don't care as much about the relationship, but it's because there is such an overwhelm happening in their body and their mind that their only way of being able to stay intact in the relationship or even in the conversation is to temporarily find shelter underground, so to speak, until the tornado passes and they can reemerge.
Right. And something that I think is really important to understand about withdrawers is that they may look very calm above the surface, right? In terms, when I say above the surface, I mean in terms of their behavior, their demeanor.
That's right.
They may look cool, calm, and collected and completely indifferent. But tell us a little bit about what's going on below the surface in their inner life.
Yes.
In and moments of conflict.
You saying that reminds me of the metaphor of like a duck floating on water on the top, just this serene being, but underground their legs are just paddling, saying, oh my gosh, don't piss them off, you know, don't say anything or do anything, you've already got yourself into enough trouble, you look how hurt that other person is, look how angry that person is at you, don't screw this up even more, you know, you obviously did or said the wrong thing to cause this, perhaps. And so if you say another thing, this is all going to go down. Your relationship is going to even worsen. So just be quiet until, again, the storm passes and maybe there'll be a chance for understanding, maybe.
Right. So tell me if I've got this right. The withdrawer strategy is to protect the relationship and preserve the relationship by hunkering down and becoming and disengaging outwardly
right
until the storm passes, so that then they can feel reconnected to their partner.
Yes. Right.
So right. The goal, as you said earlier, is exactly the same as for the pursuer. The withdrawer also wants to be in connection. but they often feel so flooded and overloaded.
That's right.
By the emotion of the pursuer, that they go, like you said, they're the flight end of fight and flight, and sometimes that even looks like freezing, right? And just not talk, not saying anything, going about their business as the drives the pursuer crazy because the pursuer feels like you're not even listening, you're not hearing me, but really the withdrawer is so flooded by fear and emotion that they've got to turn the volume down on the way that they're responding.
They have to
maintain equilibrium or try to reach equilibrium again so that reconnection can happen.
Absolutely. And just like how for pursuers, sometimes they're physically louder and sometimes they're silent. Mm-hmm. For withdrawers, this doesn't always mean they go radio silent. Sometimes this means they might exit by getting defensive, defending themselves as a way of saying, you know, I'm not that bad. Come on, you know, hoping that for, you know, that that will rationally help bring the storm down, the volume down. That could also look like being very accommodating and appeasing and saying, yes, sir, yes, ma'am, right away, and doing everything that the pursuer is wanting you to do at the cost of genuinely having your feelings be heard, at the cost of actually having your being authentic in your emotion, if that makes sense.
Yes.
Or having the pursuer understand what your needs are that aren't being met.
Right.
So right, the withdrawer can talk, can sometimes be vocal, can sometimes be extremely agreeable. Another exit could sometimes be humor, you know, a distraction from the feeling of disconnect, which can feel so overwhelming, and bring some levity to it.
Hmm.
Not to say all humorous people are withdrawers.
Right. But I've seen that. Absolutely.
Humor can be a strategy to diffuse.
Yes.
To diffuse and distract, rather than saying, I am scared. I want to be there with you. I don't know how. The more vulnerable conversations that will get you to reconnection.
Right, right. Now, it's interesting because when I first started learning about attachment, I thought, oh, INFJs are probably always pursuers. We've got that extroverted feeling that makes us, you know, really, really gives us that drive to connect with others and to place our sense of well-being in, you know, in how connected we do feel to others and the harmony that we feel in relationships. But I was dead wrong because plenty of INFJs are actually withdrawers. So another thing to understand is that I think of attachment as a spectrum, you know, in terms of insecure and secure attachment, it's a spectrum. I don't know anyone in this world who is perfectly securely attached, right?
Yes, right.
And there are all these shades and degrees of security and insecurity in between.
Thanks for saying that.
So even people who are primarily securely attached usually have a flavor of being a pursuer or a flavor of being a withdrawer, even though when two securely attached, pretty securely attached people are in a relationship, the sense of disconnection doesn't grow to the same like gargantuan proportions typically that it does in a relationship with two people who are both primarily insecurely attached. And another thing to add is that there are all different combination possibilities available in a relationship. So pursuers, getting into relationships with withdrawers is probably the most common.
Yes, by far.
The opposites really attract in that way. Mm-hmm. But there are also relationships between two pursuers where those are sort of marked by probably more volatility because both people can really turn up the volume on their attempts to reach each other and get into conflicts where each person is getting louder and louder trying to be heard. And then also relationships between two withdrawers exist, where those the volume tends to get turned way down in that relationship, as both people make very subtle attempts to connect. And then if that doesn't work or it's misunderstood, both go into a state of withdrawal.
Right.
But a fun fact is that I definitely have, personally, definitely have a flavor of being a pursuer. And Jen, do you want to talk about your flavor?
I've got this withdrawing flavor, absolutely, in my relationship.
Right. So one really cool thing about our friendship for me is that we both understand attachment. We're both INFJs, but we can really lend to each other the opposite perspective in terms of being pursuer or withdrawer.
Absolutely.
And something that I want to be really clear about for those listening is that these roles are flexible. Each of us has sort of a primary flavor based on the way that the strategies that we used in dealing with a sense of disconnection when we were infants and children and growing up. But I can say that there have been certain connections in my life with people who were even stronger pursuers than me, where I became the withdrawer and experienced for the first time what it's like to feel numb inside because you're so flooded by the angry emotion of the other person. It can feel almost dissociative. A sense of just completely losing contact with oneself, one's own emotions, and numbness takes over. I think as a pursuer, I have been guilty before having that withdrawer experience myself. I've been guilty of thinking that pursuers are actually the ones in the most pain. You know, when there's relational conflict, that pursuers really have it the worst because withdrawers just look so cool, calm, and collected. Right. They look indifferent sometimes. They look like they couldn't care less. Well, when I was in the role of withdrawer, which was these are involuntary. You don't get to choose.
Right.
I remember feeling a blanket of numbness descending on me. It felt like how can I describe it? Like emotional death. It was like death of internal emotion and vitality. It was like vitality was being drained out of me to the point where I felt tired. But it wasn't that nice, sleepy tiredness where you just cuddle in bed and, you know, get cozy and fall asleep. It was like, you know, my sense of connection to the other person and to my own vitality was being drained out of me.
Yeah, you're so right that, you know, a different part of a different flavor of us can come out depending on the dynamic of the relationship we're in. And since we're in the topic of kind of nuancing the different combinations or dances, another thing that can happen is, and this is actually a common one I see in my office, which is when there is a pursuer and withdrawer, but the pursuer has been pursuing for so long that they start to burn out.
Yes. Oh, thank you for bringing this up.
And a burned out pursuer looks a lot like a withdrawer because in some ways they start to engage in withdrawal like actions and behaviors. And usually a pursuer is saying, you know, I've been calling and calling and calling, and now I am starting to believe that you will never answer the call. You will never understand. And this, and once they start to lessen their call, sometimes this is when the withdrawers start to really panic on the outside and say, let's go to therapy. Let's work on this. And so by the time they get into my office, it can look like on the outside, the roles have reversed, where the withdrawer is now saying, you know, I don't know how to fix this, but we got to do something. I want to say this. And the pursuer is saying, my trust has been so shattered that I don't know if I can put my heart out there again.
Right.
I don't know if I can revive hope because it's already hurts too bad. And I think I might be one foot out the door. Yes. So that is a case where the pursuer is burned out and saying, I don't know if I can keep calling out in this relationship.
Right. Yes. Mm-hmm. For those of you listening, we're just about to close, but I want to make sure to talk about how to find help if you are recognizing yourself in one of these attachment styles, pursuer or withdrawer, or you're recognizing your relationship in what we're discussing, and you want to be able to find healing for your personal attachment style and or for your relationship. Jen, do you remember offhand the website for the main emotionally focused therapy website address? Because there's a Find a Therapist directory on that website where people can find emotionally focused therapists, attachment trained therapists, for couples therapy or for individual therapy, even for family therapy, if that's something, if this is a type of healing that you listening feel like you really want to pursue.
Yes, it's ICEEFT.com, which stands for, I'm peeking right now in a different window, the International Center for Excellence in Emotionally Focused Therapy. So ICEEFT.com.
Right. And so it's like the word ICE and then EFT.com.
That's right.
Right. Mm-hmm. So wherever you're located, you can find somebody. There are EFT therapists all over the world now, actually, which is really exciting. So take a look, see if there's someone near you. And Jen, where can people find you personally, personally?
You can find me on my website, which is jenlumtherapy.com, JENLUMtherapy.com. And great. My website is under renovation, but there is a little place if you want to leave me a message and I'll get your message.
Great. I cannot say enough about Jen's couples therapy. I have the privilege of being able to refer individuals I work with in therapy to Jen when they want to work on their relationship in couples therapy. And I've just seen the power of a practitioner who really understands the below the surface emotional level emotions and drives that cause detachment, even when what we're really yearning for is connection. So I can't recommend Jen highly enough for couples therapy.
Well, thank you, Joy. It is always an extra treat when we can collaborate and really fully support a couple 360 with individual and couples therapy. Yes. So it's always a pleasure to have a chance to work with you, Joy.
Thank you so much for being here today, Jen.
Thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. What a privilege to have you with us. So for those of you watching and listening, thank you so much for being here today for our workshop, INFJs and Attachment Styles, What Causes Distance and Pain in the Connections That Mean the Most to Us. And I can't wait to sit down with you again soon. Take care.
Bye.